The Abyss. Part 7. A Society of Addicts. Chapter 22. At the center of all our problems is us. Enlightenment. Case 1. Mrs. Blank was confined on the 7th of May at 5 o'clock p.m. after a natural labor of 6 hours. At 12 o'clock at night, on the 9th, 31 hours after confinement, she was taken with severe chill, previous to which she was as comfortable as women usually are under the circumstances. She died on the 10th. This was a typical case of puerperal fever, an epidemic that was sweeping across Europe and America in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Though fatalities resulting from complications during childbirth were not uncommon in those days, sometimes affecting as many as 6% to 12% of childbirths, this was much worse. At the height of the epidemic, puerperal fever was responsible for killing as many as 70 to 80% of women who gave birth in some hospitals. The symptoms, which included fever and abdominal pain, would strike only days after a mother gave birth. Death often followed shortly after. So devastating were the effects of the disease that it was called the Black Death of childbed. Needless to say, the intensity and pervasiveness of puerperal fever sent shockwaves through the medical community and caused a considerable amount of anxiety among the doctors of the day, who were attempting to convince people that their hospital care was far superior to the care people relied on at home. The good news was that this was the age of enlightenment in Europe and America, a period that saw the rise of an intellectual class determined to reform society by replacing tradition and faith with science and rational analysis. Also known as the Age of Reason, it was a time when empirical data was the name of the game and expertise was the currency. Enlightened physicians of the day drew from complex theories based on their own experiences and studies to explain the puerperal fever epidemic and offer sometimes equally complex ideas for how to prevent its spread. But for all their good intentions, for all their science and data, for all the complex models they developed, the doctors failed to consider one significant factor in the spread of the puerperal fever: themselves. In an earnest attempt to advance their thinking and figure out a solution to this scourge, it was common for intellectually driven surgeons to perform autopsies in the morning, study the victims for clues, then attend to patients in the afternoon. The idea of germs, however, was not yet well understood, and the surgeons frequently did not properly wash their hands or sterilize their instruments. It was not until 1843 that an American physician in Boston, Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, father of Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., proposed in an essay in the New England Quarterly Journal of Medicine and Surgery that it was the doctors themselves who were responsible for the spread of the disease. He insisted that doctors had a moral obligation to purify their instruments and burn the clothing they wore when administering care to infected women. Though it originally went largely unnoticed, Dr. Holmes's essay did stir controversy among some of his peers. He came under attack from many of those he accused of doing accidental harm. "Doctors are not the cause," said one critic. "They are gentlemen." But the body of evidence that Holmes had collected was hard to dispute. The more doctors performed autopsies on women killed by the deadly disease, the more women were infected. Some of the doctors performing the autopsies even contracted the disease themselves. Still, it wasn't until 12 years after his original essay was published that the rest of the medical community accepted responsibility and began adequate sterilization practices. Only after the men who claimed to offer the solution accepted the way they conducted their business was part of the problem did puerperal fever all but disappear. The corollary between the spread of puerperal fever and the dangerous disease affecting our business culture today is disturbingly close. We live in the new age of enlightenment. Only now, our men of science are men of business and economics, who rely on metrics, drives for efficiency, lean, Six Sigma, calculations of returns on investment, and empirical data as the preferred means to guide decisions. And with all our numbers and systems, we require a greater reliance on managers to manage them. And like our inability to see the forest for the trees, Sometimes we can't see beyond the system or the resource to be managed to see the people doing all the work. The bigger the scale, the more abstract things become. And the more abstract things become, the more we rely on numbers to keep track of it all. It makes perfect sense. The fact that the conditions that existed before each of our stock market crashes, except for the oil crisis in the 1970s, were nearly identical cannot be mere coincidence. Like Dr. Holmes, we need to look at ourselves for answers. Leadership is about taking responsibility for lives and not numbers. Managers look after our numbers and our results, and leaders look after us. All managers of metrics have an opportunity to become leaders of people. Just as every doctor in our country learned the importance of sterilizing their instruments, so too must every leader of every organization do the little things necessary to protect their people. But first, they have to admit that they are the root of the problem. A very modern addiction. It was the most incredible feeling. It worked like magic. Any sense of despair or discomfort, any unease or insecurity, any fears or anxieties, even feelings of intimidation caused by another person or situation, were gone. He felt like he was in a state repaired, as he called it. He felt that he could do anything. He felt like he was the person he wanted to be. This is how John felt when he drank. Dutch courage, some call it. The boost of confidence we can get from a couple of drinks. If a guy is at a bar with a couple of friends, and he makes eye contact with someone he finds attractive on the other side of the room, all he needs to do is walk over and introduce himself. But that can be intimidating to a lot of men. A drink or two is all it takes to calm the nerves and find the courage to walk across the room. Now multiply the anxiety and the courage needed to face the world by an exponential amount, and we can start to understand the power and importance alcohol plays in an alcoholic's life. Thanks to the dopamine released by the alcohol, the feelings of struggle, intimidation, fear, anxiety, and paranoia go away when they drink. This is one of the reasons taking control of alcoholism is so difficult. All the problems an alcoholic may face, stress at work, stress in a relationship, stress with finances, and any feelings of inadequacy, all get worse and more difficult to confront when sober. Others have a drink and go home, explained one alcoholic. I had to drink to leave home. For a huge number of those affected by the disease of alcoholism, their drinking began when they were teenagers. It is a time in our lives when almost all of us have to deal with feelings of insecurity and inadequacy. It is a time when we transition from needing the approval of our parents to needing the approval of our peers, a need that lasts a lifetime. Social awareness and our desire to belong or fit in are part of our anthropological growth. We all want to feel like we are a welcome and valuable part of a group. Concern for what others think about us is a natural part of our becoming social, and it is necessary for our survival as a species that lives in groups, even if it's confounding for our parents during those teenage years. Combined with our budding sexuality and changing bodies, the social anxiety, sense of confusion, and self-doubt during this time can be, for many adolescents, overwhelming. This is the reason for supportive parents, teachers, friends, and community. This is, in part, the value of the family dinner, team sports, hobbies, and extracurricular activities. It is the strong support network we build during this fragile period that teach us that we need others to help us cope and survive. But some teenagers accidentally discover that the magical forces of alcohol can be a much quicker way to find strength and confidence. Left unchecked, alcohol can become a substitute for relying on other people for support during periods of self-doubt. This is important because the way we learn to deal with our struggles and anxieties during adolescence is likely to become the way we deal with these challenges for the rest of our adult lives. Using alcohol or cigarettes or binge eating to put our minds at rest is highly effective. These activities can all be done alone without the help or support of anyone around us. They all work immediately or close to it. In other words, it doesn't require much work to find the calm or relief we get when we drink or smoke. It happens basically at the same time we drink or smoke. The pleasure we derive from alcohol or nicotine or food all comes from dopamine. Dopamine is the chemical that is released when we accomplish something or find something we're looking for. It is one of our internal incentives, designed to encourage us to look for food, finish building a shelter, and generally make progress as a species. It is designed to keep us engaging in behaviors that are supposed to be in the interest of our survival and prosperity. Mother Nature could not have imagined or prepared us for a time when chemicals like nicotine and alcohol would be available to short-circuit our reward systems. Dopamine was built for a time when food was not readily available. Our bodies weren't built for a food-whenever-we-want-it world. Binging, gambling, drinking, and smoking are all ostensibly dopamine addictions. They are easy ways to get the shot of dopamine we love and crave. And when we are unable to keep our desire for dopamine bursts in check, they become addictions. We reach a point where a chemical designed to help keep us alive actually rewards us for engaging in behaviors that can harm us. This is exactly what has been happening in our corporate cultures, where incentive programs create environments ripe for a new kind of dopamine-driven addiction. We're addicted to performance. Have a dopamine addiction. You earned it. Our Paleolithic ancestors prepared for the hunt, excited about what the day might bring. Their ability to imagine what their goal looks like and the rewards it may confer on them gives them their first shot of dopamine as they set off. One of the hunters finds some clues to indicate that a gazelle has been in the area. There's another shot of dopamine to encourage them to keep going. One spots a gazelle in the distance, then a bigger shot of dopamine as they track the animal for the next few hours. Finally, they get a rush of adrenaline and excitement. At the point of the kill, dopamine surges through their bodies, giving them a huge sense of accomplishment. They congratulate one another and thank their trusted leader, serotonin now coursing through everyone's veins. They slap and hug one another, feeling intense bonds of brotherhood with those who have been out in the muck with them for these few days. The oxytocin reinforces their bond. The fearless hunters bring the food back to the tribe, who shower them with praise and respect. The serotonin flows again. The rest of the tribe feels looked after and grateful for the risks the hunters took for them, and everyone feels good and enjoys a tasty meal together. Like our prehistoric predecessors seeking food, in the business world today, we receive a burst of dopamine with each marker we hit on the way toward our end goal. Unfortunately, unlike our ancestors, we are working within environments in which the reward systems are unbalanced. Dopamine-releasing incentives predominate. Our incentive structures are almost entirely based on hitting goals and getting financial rewards for doing so. What's more, they are usually set up to reward individual performance on achieving short-term goals, a month, quarter, or year. They can even end up pitting co-workers against each other, accidentally promoting behaviors that undermine the progress of the group as a whole. One of my favorite examples comes from the heady days of America Online, AOL. The company would routinely send out CDs in an attempt to get people to sign up for its product. One group within the company, responsible for acquisitions, was given financial incentives for hitting subscription goals. And so, all tactics were designed to do just that, sign people up. There were offers of 100 free hours in the first month, which became 250 free hours, then even 700 hours. I remember when the offer got to 1,000 free hours, as long as they were used in the first 45 days, which left 1.7 hours of sleep per night for anyone who could take advantage of the promotion. It worked. Whatever tactics the acquisition group members developed were designed to do one thing and one thing only: maximize their bonus. The problem was, there was another group responsible for retention. They had to find ways to get all the people who had canceled their subscriptions to come back. By creating a system in which each group was preoccupied with its own metrics, without concern for anyone else's or even what would serve the company best, the leaders of AOL had effectively incentivized their people to find ways to cost the company more money. For the most part, the incentive structures we offer inside our companies do not reward us for cooperating, sharing information, or reaching across the company to offer or ask for help. In other words, there is little positive reinforcement when it comes to behaviors and actions critical to maintaining the circle of safety. Whether intentionally or not, they are designed not only to allow dopamine addiction to happen, but to cultivate and encourage it. And like all addictions, this one has consequences. our judgment gets cloudy, we become less concerned with outsiders, and selfishness takes hold. We become obsessed with finding our next hit, and we won't let anyone or anything stand in our way. Chapter 23, At Any Expense. There are regulations to manage the drilling of oil so that we can reap the benefits of the resource while also preserving the land from which we extract it. Other regulations keep car and machine emissions in check to ensure that we can have our conveniences and still maintain air quality. This is what good regulations do. They attempt to balance the benefit and the cost of that benefit. It is an inexact science, but few would disagree that imbalance, one way or the other, would be damaging to commerce or our lives. And so the process of trying to maintain the balance continues in earnest. In the early 20th century, the electromagnetic spectrum was viewed as a publicly owned natural resource, and a scarce one at that. With the arrival of radio, the broadcast industry was a bit like the Wild West, with too many broadcasters attempting to be heard on a limited number of wavelengths. And so Congress passed the Radio Act of 1927 to help organize the system. The act was later replaced by the Communications Act of 1934, which also introduced the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, as part of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. The new act and the new commission also took responsibility for the new medium of television and, as with radio, did the work of helping the broadcast industry grow while also protecting the public's access to information. One of the ways in which the FCC could regulate the limited resource was to require broadcasters to have a license to broadcast on the public spectrum. One of the requirements to obtain a broadcast license was for the networks to provide public service programming for the community from whose airwaves it was profiting. The networks feared they would lose their licenses to operate if they did not comply, and thus was born the evening news. Programming meant to serve the public interest apart from the commercial interest of the rest of the network programming. Though the networks didn't make a lot of money from the news, they did gain something just as important to their businesses, something that money couldn't buy, a reputation for integrity. Walter Cronkite, who served as anchorman of the CBS Evening News from 1962 to 1981, was considered the most trusted man in America, a reputation that clearly benefited the entire CBS organization. Both Cronkite and the other newsmen of the day thought of themselves as having a mission. We were sort of driven during the 1960s by this quasi-religious drive to give people the information they needed to have, says Ted Koppel, the award-winning newsman and former host of Nightline. The news fulfilled an obligation to the public. It was ostensibly the lost leader that permitted NBC, CBS, and ABC to justify the enormous profits made by their entertainment divisions, Koppel explains. It never occurred to the network brass that news programming could be profitable. The system of give and take was balanced. But near the end of 1979, something happened. On November 4th, a group of Islamist students and militants stormed the American embassy in Tehran and took captive 52 Americans. Not long after, ABC News debuted America Held Hostage, the Iran Crisis, a series developed expressly to cover developments in the hostage crisis. Later renamed Nightline, the show Ted Koppel anchored for 25 years, gave Americans an update on the crisis every night of the 444-day ordeal. The program was instantly popular, and for the first time in news history, the network executives took notice. Instead of leaving the news alone to be run by cause-driven, idealistic journalists, they began to see the news as a profit center, and so they started to get more involved. Though programs like 60 Minutes, which had already been on the air for more than a decade, were profitable, they didn't air every night. They weren't the nightly news. What's more, this was a different time. It was now the 1980s. America's wealth and affluence were at an all-time high, and our desire for more wealth and affluence became a force that would drive nearly every facet of life in the country for the decade and beyond, including in broadcast television. Our craving for dopamine was on the rise. The balance was about to tip. With the end of the Iran hostage crisis came the Reagan administration, and with it, a new broadcast sheriff moved into town, newly appointed FCC chairman Mark Fowler. Fowler and many of his supporters saw broadcast television, including television news, as just another business trying to make a buck. With the advent of cable television and the introduction of CNN, the news began to transform from a public service and the jewel in the crown of the networks into a 24-hour opportunity to get more jewels. Any obstacle that stood in the way of the networks achieving another hit had to be eliminated. The job of the regulator was no longer to provide protection, but to help drive profit. One by one, sometimes with the support of Congress and sometimes acting alone, Fowler and the FCC slowly dismantled all the standards to which networks needed to adhere to qualify for a broadcast license, standards that aimed to maintain at least some sense of balance by serving the public good. For starters, the time that networks had to renew their licenses was extended from 3 to 5 years, meaning the old fear of losing a license became less of a concern. The number of stations a single company could own went from 7 to 12, giving each holding company a greater opportunity to try to seize more market share. Any provisions for how much advertising could be carried were also eliminated. Fowler's FCC even went so far as to abolish the guidelines that set the minimum amount of non-entertainment programming a network was required to air as a condition of its ability to profit from the public airwaves. The very purpose of the 1934 Act, to reel in the Wild West of the industry and ensure that each network would also offer a public service, was now destroyed. And it didn't stop there. Perhaps the greatest casualty in the network and TV news business came in 1987 with the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine was introduced in 1949 to prevent a broadcaster from using a network to advocate one perspective. The doctrine provided that any broadcaster granted a license by the FCC would, as a condition of its license, agree not only to discuss controversial topics that would be in the interest of the public, but also to ensure that any views expressed would be balanced by opposing voices. With that provision having been eliminated, our modern networks now have the right to take a partisan perspective and be as polarizing as they like, whatever is good for business. What the Committee for the Fair Broadcasting of Controversial Issues in 1973 called indispensable and the single most important requirement of operation in the public interest had been disposed of. The path was now completely cleared for news as a service to be replaced by news as another platform on which to sell advertising. As the pursuit of greater abundance continued throughout the 1980s, the destruction of the industry's trust-building elements seemed unstoppable, and the dopamine flowed. No one disputes the right of a company's leaders to grow their businesses in any way they choose, as long as the means they choose are not harmful to the people they claim to serve. The problem is the news business seems to have forgotten the people it is supposed to serve. If we consider the current state of television news, we get a perfect view of what happens when the drive to be first, or boost ratings, is put ahead of the drive to serve the public interest. Among the worst symptoms is the media's willingness to woefully underreport important stories, while it overindulges in the kinds of stories that it might entertain, but hardly inform. Now more than ever, the mission of delivering information has become the business of delivering news. What has happened is not because of journalists. In fact, a good many of them are still driven by the quasi-religious commitment to reporting the truth that Koppel described. The problem lies with the media executives who see the dissemination of information as part of their business portfolios and not as something driven by mission. These executives quickly defend their products as fulfilling their obligation to provide a public service, but their claims are untenable. It is a clear conflict of interest if they count the Nielsen ratings and set advertising rates accordingly. Like a doctor who prescribes the drugs their patients ask for, and not just the ones they need, Koppel says that news organizations went from delivering the news you need, even if you don't want it, to the news you want, even if you don't need it. He laments the bygone days when being a part of a news organization meant something, when it was more of a noble pursuit than a commercial pursuit, a time when newsrooms made the news interesting instead of what they do today, make interesting news. Whether it is a congressman courting donors instead of spending more time responding to the needs of constituents, or a leader of a company who opts to sell products they know might have harmful ingredients because it is profitable, the race to win has always existed and has always caused problems. In healthy organizations, as in healthy society, the drive to win should not precede the desire to take care of the very people we claim to serve. More, more, more. Before the stock market crashed in 1929, there were 25,000 banks in America. However, so many of them were built on such unstable foundations that roughly half of them went out of business in the years immediately following the crash. In 1933, Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act, then known as the Banking Act of 1933, in an attempt to curb the excessive risk-taking and the speculation of the banking industry so future generations would not find themselves in the same predicament. In addition to the introduction of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, an independent body that preserves and promotes public confidence in the U.S. financial system, other provisions were instituted to reduce the risk the public and the country would have to bear as the banks looked to advance their own interests. One of the most significant provisions of the Act separated commercial banking from investment banking. Commercial banks exist to offer what would be considered traditional banking services, receiving deposits, cashing checks, offering loans, and so on. Investment banks, in contrast, are able to issue securities to help a client raise capital, as well as offer other services, including the trading of equities, commodities, and other financial instruments. Seeing that commercial banks were depositories for personal and business funds, Congress at the time decided that those funds should be off-limits to any investment bank to use for their own speculative and risk-taking ventures. Unfortunately, the future generations our predecessors were trying to protect were less reluctant to risk the public interest to pave the way for new revenue streams. And so, in 1999, at the height of the dot-com boom, during a time of wild speculation, the majority of the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. The repeal of the Act was justified, as then-Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers said, to, quote, enable American companies to compete in the new economy, unquote. This is political rhetoric to disguise the true intention, to remove regulations specifically designed to protect the public welfare in order to largely help one industry, banking, get bigger so that one group, bankers, could get more hits of dopamine. If competing in the new economy means creating conditions for stock market crashes, then the politicians and the banking lobbies did a great job. With the Act in place, very few large banks failed between 1933 and 1999. And there have only been three significant stock market crashes in the United States since the crash that caused the Great Depression in 1929. Again, there was one crash in 1973, which is the result of a sudden rise in the oil prices and not a banking crisis. Another in 2000 was due to careless betting on the dot-com bubble. The third crash in 2008 resulted from the excessive speculation and risk-taking on the part of the banking industry, as well as the use of mortgage-backed securities. The conditions for the 2008 crash were fueled by companies like Citigroup, previously a commercial bank, and the American International Group, AIG, an insurance company dealing in securities, a practice that would have been forbidden if the Banking Act of 1933 had not been eviscerated less than a decade before. The repeal of most of Glass-Steagall is one of the most obvious and extreme examples of the attempts of some of the me-first boomers to bend or break the laws in the name of self-gain. It's an example of what happens when our leaders put their interests ahead of those they're supposed to protect. On a side note, the events during the period of destructive abundance all happened under the watchful eye of America's first baby boomer president, Bill Clinton, born August 19, 1946. Addiction has a terrible way of making us lose sight of reality. Like an addict who wakes up regretting what they did under the influence the night before, there are many of the boomer generation who now look back at the destruction accidentally wrought under their watch. And for some of those in charge at the time, the destruction seems to have had a humbling effect. In an interview with Bloomberg Television in 2010, David Kamansky, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, who Stanley O'Neill replaced, said that it was a mistake to repeal Glass-Steagall. Unfortunately, I was one of the people who led the charge to get Glass-Steagall repealed, he said. Of course, when I was running a firm, I didn't want them to strictly enforce the rules. Kamansky now concedes, I regret those activities and wish we hadn't done that. John Reed, the former co-CEO of Citigroup Incorporated, also said that it was a bad idea to repeal Glass-Steagall. What is it about former CEOs that they are suddenly able to have a kind of sober clarity we wished they had when they were in charge? I understand that we all have 20/20 hindsight, but don't we pay these leaders for their vision and foresight? Beginning in earnest in the 1980s and 1990s, some members of the boomer generation oversaw the steady dismantling of the very controls that were designed to protect us from excess, imbalance, and addiction in our system. The leaders of companies and leaders in government created a strong inner circle with little regard for the protections that are supposed to be offered to others. Just as leaders of any organization are supposed to look after those in their care, which ultimately makes their organization stronger, leaders of companies are also supposed to consider the care of the environment in which they operate. This includes the economy writ large and even civilized society. The circle of safety built to make as many Americans as possible feel safe is now slowly breaking apart, leaving us exposed to greater danger. It weakens a country just as it weakens a company when we have to focus on protecting ourselves from ourselves instead of working together to protect and advance the country as a whole. And if we think the next generation is equipped to fix the problems of the generation before them, we must remind ourselves that they are dealing with addictions of their own. Chapter 24, The Abstract Generation. The Biggest Losers. This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can, and don't have any kids yourself. Philip Larkin's 1971 poem paints a bit of a dreary picture of parenting, but sadly, there is some truth in it. The period of destructive abundance in which we are currently living is due in large part to the good intentions of our parents and their parents before them. The greatest generation, raised during the Great Depression and wartime rationing, wanted to ensure that their children did not suffer or miss out on their youth as they did. This is good. This is what all parents want for their children, to avoid their hardships and prosper. And so that's how the boomers were raised, to believe that they shouldn't have to go without, which, as a philosophy, is perfectly fine and reasonable. But given the size of the generation and the abundance of resources that surrounded them, the philosophy got a little distorted. When you consider the rising wealth and affluence of their childhood, combined for good reasons with the cynicism towards government in the 1970s, followed by the boom years of the 1980s and 1990s, and it's easy to see how the boomers earned their reputation as the me generation, me before we. Putting the protection of ideas and wealth before the sharing of them is now standard. A New Jersey-based accountant told me that he sees a clear difference between his older clients and his younger ones. My older clients want to work within the confines of the tax code to do what is fair, he explained. They are willing to simply pay the tax they owe. The next generation spends a lot of time looking to exploit every loophole and nuance in the tax code to reduce their responsibility to as little as possible. When the boomers started having children of their own, they raised their children to be skeptical of those in charge. Don't let people get things from you if they aren't willing to compensate you for it, goes the thinking. Don't let anything stand in the way of what you want. Again, all reasonable philosophies, if the circumstances today were the same as the 1960s and 70s, but they aren't. And so a few good ideas got a little twisted for the boomers' kids. Generations X and Y were taught to believe they could get whatever they want. Gen X, growing up before the internet, interpreted that lesson as putting your head down and getting to work. An overlooked and forgotten generation, Gen Xers didn't really rebel against anything or stand for much in their youth. Sure, there was the Cold War, but it was the nicer, gentler version of the Cold War than existed in the 1960s and 70s. Gen Xers didn't grow up practicing drills at school in case of nuclear attack. Growing up in the 1980s was a good life. The 1990s and the new millennium saw even more boom years. Dot-com, e-commerce, email, e-dating, free overnight shipping, no waiting, get it now. Generation Y is said to have a sense of entitlement. Many employers complain of the demands their entry-level employees often make. But I, as one observer, do not believe it is a sense of entitlement. This generation wants to work hard and is willing to work hard. What we perceive as entitlement is, in fact, impatience. And impatience driven by two things. First is a gross misunderstanding that things like success, money, or happiness come instantly. Even though our messages and books arrive the same day we want them, our careers and fulfillment do not. The second element is more unsettling. It is the result of a horrible short circuit to their internal reward systems. These Gen Yers have grown up in a world in which huge scale is normal, money is valued over service, and technology is used to manage relationships. The economic systems in which they have grown up, ones that prioritize numbers over people, are blindly accepted, as if that's the way it's always been. If steps are not taken to overcome or mitigate the quantity of abstraction in their lives, in time, they may be the biggest losers of their parents' excess. And while Gen Yers may be more affected by the short-circuiting because they grew up in this world, the fact is, none of us are immune. The Distracted Generation. Imagine you are sitting on a plane flying at 35,000 feet and 525 miles per hour from New York to Seattle. It's a calm flight. There's no turbulence. It's a clear day, and the captain predicts the whole flight will be a smooth one. Both the captain and co-pilot are seasoned pilots with many, many years of experience, and the aircraft is equipped with the most modern avionics and warning systems. As required by the FAA, both pilots fly the airline simulator a few times a year to practice dealing with various emergencies. 100 miles away, in a dark room in a building with no windows, sits an air traffic controller with 10 years of experience, looking down a scope, monitoring all the air traffic in his assigned sector. Your flight is currently in his sector. Now imagine that the controller has his cell phone next to him. He's not allowed to make calls while he's on duty, but he can send and receive text messages or access his email. Imagine that he can relay coordinates to a flight, check his messages, relay coordinates to another flight, check his phone again. Seems fair, right? As plain as the nose is on my face, I'm confident that the vast majority of us would not be very comfortable with this scenario. We would prefer that the air traffic controller check his email or send his text messages during his breaks. I think we would all feel much better if access to the internet and a personal cell phone were completely forbidden, which they are. Only because our lives are at stake do we see this example as stark. So if we take the life and death part away, why would we think that we can do our work, check our phones, write a paragraph, send a text, write another paragraph, send another text, without the same damage to our ability to concentrate? Generation Y thinks that because they have grown up with all the technologies, they are better at multitasking. I would venture to argue they are not better at multitasking. What they are better at is being distracted. According to a study at Northwestern University, the number of children and young people diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, shot up 66% between 2000 and 2010. Why the sudden huge spike in a frontal lobe dysfunction over the course of a decade? The Centers for Disease Control defines those with ADHD as often having trouble paying attention or controlling impulsive behaviors, may act without thinking about what the result will be, or being overly active. I would submit that this huge spike is not simply because more people have ADHD than previous generations, though this could be true, nor is it due to an increase in the number of parents having their children tested, though this could also be true. Though there are, of course, many genuine cases of ADHD, the sudden spike may be the result of something as simple as misdiagnosis. What I believe is likely happening, however, is that many more young people are developing an addiction to distraction. An entire generation has become addicted to the dopamine-producing effects of text messages, emails, and other online activities. We know that sometimes our wires can get crossed, and the wrong behaviors can be incentivized. Someone who finds the dopamine and serotonin-releasing effects of alcohol as a teenager can become conditioned to look to alcohol to suppress emotional pain instead of learning to look to people for support. This can show up later in life as alcoholism. In this same way, the dopamine-releasing effects of the bing, buzz, or flash of a cell phone feel good and create the desire and drive to repeat the behavior that produces that feeling. Even if we're in the middle of something, it feels good to check our phones immediately instead of waiting 15 minutes to complete our original task. Once addicted, the craving is insatiable. When the phone dings while we are driving, we must look immediately to see who just sent us a text. When we are trying to get some work done and our phones vibrate across the desk, we break concentration and have to look. If boomers are getting their dopamine from goals oriented around more and bigger, then Gen Y is getting their dopamine from anything that satisfies faster or now. Cigarettes are out, social media is in. It's the drug of the 21st century. At least people who smoke stand outside together. Like alcoholism or drug addiction, this new disease is making our youngest generation impatient at best and at worst feel lonelier and more isolated than the generations before. Where alcohol replaced trusting relationships as a coping mechanism for teenagers who grew up to be alcoholics, so too are the positive affirmations we get from social media and the virtual relationships we maintain replacing real, trusting relationships as coping mechanisms. A side effect could be a generation that struggles to find happiness and fulfillment even more than the generations that preceded them. Though there is a desire to do good, their acculturated impatience means that few will commit time or effort to do one thing long enough to see the effect of service. The thing we know gives a sense of fulfillment. In doing research for this book, I kept meeting amazing, wonderful, smart, driven, and optimistic Gen Yers who were either disillusioned with their entry-level jobs or quitting to find a new job that will allow me to make an impact in the world, discounting the time and energy that is required to do it. It's like they're standing at the foot of a mountain, looking at the effect they want to have or the success they want to feel at the peak. There is nothing wrong with looking for a faster way to scale the mountain. If they want to take a helicopter or invent a climbing machine that gets them up there quicker, more power to them. What they seem to fail to notice, however, is the mountain. The see-it-and-get-it generation has an awareness of where they are standing, and they know where they want to get to. What they can't seem to understand is the journey, the very time-consuming journey. They seem flummoxed when told that things take time. They are happy to give lots of short bursts of energy and effort to things, but commitment and grit come harder. Giving a lot of oneself to a small number of things seems to have been replaced by giving a little bit of oneself to a large number of things. This tendency is exemplified by the way many Gen Yers respond to various social causes. They rallied to share the Kony video with their friends. Many posted pictures of themselves in hoodies to support Trayvon Martin. They texted donations to tsunami relief organizations. There is an intense excitement to do good, to help, to support. Yet after the dopamine hit is felt, it's on to the next. Without giving any significant amount of time or energy, a generation comfortable with abstraction has confused real commitment with symbolic gestures. One brand that offers young, fashionable do-gooders the opportunity to do good without actually doing anything is One Face. Customers can buy a watch in the color that represents the cause of their choice. For example, white to stamp out hunger, or pink to stamp out breast cancer. According to the One Face website, an unspecified portion of profits go to the related charities. The problem is, ask the watch wearer what good they are doing, and they will likely tell you that they are helping to raise awareness. That's the Gen Y catch-all. There is so much talk about awareness or driving the conversation that we fail to notice that talk doesn't solve problems. The investment of time and energy by real human beings does. Justifying such campaigns by saying they put pressure on others to do things only supports my argument that we seem less inclined to offer our own time and energy to do what needs to be done, insisting rather that others do it for us. It also reveals a limitation of the internet. An amazing vehicle for spreading information, the web is great for making people aware of the plight of others, but it is quite limited in its ability to alleviate that plight. The plight of others is not a technology problem, it's a human one, and only humans can solve human problems. As money replaced the expense of time and energy, now brands that offer people the chance to do good by not actually doing anything replace service. Neither fulfills the human need to do real hard work for the benefit of others. Neither fulfills the sacrifice requirements for serotonin or oxytocin. The dopamine drive for instant gratification at best means we, as individuals, keep giving to various causes without ever feeling any sense of belonging or lasting fulfillment. At worst, however, feelings of loneliness and isolation can lead to dangerous antisocial behavior. The dire scenario. Disappointed and disillusioned, baby boomers are killing themselves in greater numbers than ever before. According to a 2013 study by the Centers for Disease Control, suicide rates among baby boomers rose nearly 30% during the past decade, making suicide one of the leading causes of death in that age group, behind only cancer and heart disease. The biggest jump in suicides was among men in their 50s. This age group experienced a whopping 50% increase. With the increase of suicides among boomers, more people now die of suicide than from car accidents. Unless we do something, my fear is that it's only going to get worse. The problem is that in 20 to 30 years, when our youngest generation grows up and takes charge of government and business, its members will have grown up using Facebook, prescription drugs, or online support groups as their primary coping mechanisms, rather than relying on real support groups, biological bonds of friendship, and loving relationships. I predict we will see a rise in depression, prescription drug abuse, suicide, and other antisocial behaviors. In 1960, the number of notable school shootings was 1. In the 1980s, there were 27. The 1990s saw 58 school shootings. And from 2000 until 2012, there were 102 school shootings. This may seem crazy, but it's an increase of more than 10,000% in just over 50 years. More than 70% of the shooters in all the shootings since 2000 were born after 1980, and a disturbingly high number were around the age of 14 or 15. Though some had diagnosed mental disorders, all felt lonely, outcast, and disassociated from their schools, communities, or families. In almost every case, these young murderers were either victims of bullying themselves or felt ostracized because of their social awkwardness or history of family troubles. Sick gazelles are pushed to the edge of the herd, pushed out of the circle of safety, so the lions might eat the weaker ones instead of the stronger ones. Our primitive mammal brains lead us to the same conclusion. When we feel like we are outside the circle of safety, with no sense of belonging and no sense that others love and care for us, we feel out of control, abandoned, and left for dead. And when we feel that isolated, we become desperate. Virtual relationships can't help solve this problem. In fact, they could be making the situation worse. People who spend excessive time on Facebook frequently become depressed as they compare the perception of their lives with the perception of the lives of others. A 2013 study by social psychologists at the University of Michigan tracked the Facebook use of 82 young adults over a 2-week period. At the start of the study, they rated how satisfied they were with their lives. The researchers then checked in with the subjects every 2 hours, 5 times a day, to see how they were feeling about themselves and how much time they were spending on Facebook. The more time they spent on Facebook since the last check-in, the worse they felt. And at the end of the 2 weeks, the subjects who spent the most time overall on Facebook reported less satisfaction with their lives. Rather than enhancing well-being, the study concluded, interacting with Facebook may predict the opposite result for young adults. It may undermine it. So that's where we stand. The me generation, addicted to performance, dismantled the controls that protect us from corporate abuses and stock market crashes. The distracted generation, living in a world of abstraction, thinks it has ADHD, but more likely has a dopamine-fueled addiction to social media and cell phones. It would seem we have reached the abyss. So what are we to do? The good news is, we are our own best hope.